And good day, everyone. Sorry for the few minutes delay to get up and running, but here we are. You are listening to Beyond the Matrix with Patricia Corey, the program that dares you to think outside the box of convention. And that is what we're going to do as long as I have anything to say about that. So I'll be doing that in great style today, and I'm going to even ignore all of my usual announcements to not waste a minute to introduce my guest. This book, okay, needless to say, I am all things UFO and ETs entice me, and I've got a book sitting in front of me called Crash, When UFOs Fall from the Sky, A History of Famous Incidents, Conspiracies, and Cover-Ups. And that sounded like something I wanted to find out about. Then, when I started investigating, turns out the author, Kevin Randall, has a military background. So here's a guy who comes from the military, who talks profusely, he's got lots of books out, and is delving in to cover-ups, conspiracies, our kind of stuff. Let me just introduce him. Kevin Randall has more than 35 years of study in the UFO phenomenon, as he calls it, in all its incarnations. He's been trained in the Army as a helicopter pilot, an intelligence officer, ooh, creepy, and military policeman, and by the Air Force. So, okay, I hope that he realizes I'm out there. Welcome, Kevin. Thank you for taking a time to come on my show.
Well, when you say you're out there, where out there are you?
I don't know, but I'm out there someplace where intelligence offer makes me go zippy.
I don't know why, because as an intelligence officer, my function was merely to gather information and report it to our soldiers so that they would be able to complete their follow-on mission. So it wasn't anything spectacular that I was doing as an intelligence officer.
Okay, but surely uncovering conspiracies and cover-ups would be in the zone of kind of creepy.
Well, yes,
how did you blend the two aspects, on the one side being an intelligence officer for the government, and on the other exploring and writing about cover-ups and conspiracies?
There's just separate occupations. One is the things I was doing as a civilian, and the other was something that I was doing to make some money. And what is interesting is when I became an intelligence officer, they were required to do a background investigation because you're required to have a top-secret clearance. It turns out the guy who was doing the investigation lived across the street from my father. So I learned later that one of the things they had done was buy a number of the magazine articles I'd written, a couple of them very critical of the Air Force, and put them in the file for the background investigation. But I still got the clearance, even with those critical statements about the Air Force. So it didn't really impact what I was doing.
Well, that's encouraging to hear. Oh-ho! All right, well, let's start at the beginning, because I've never, I'm embarrassed to say I've never read any of your work until now, and I didn't have time to go. This is a very intricate book full of science and dates and history, and I've only just begun to really get into it. I couldn't get into it in time for the interview, so I would appreciate, for the people that are listening, if you would just give us a quick background on who you are and what got you started in researching UFO crashes and the whole UFO phenomenon.
And I find I become most inarticulate when I'm beginning to talk about myself in that way. As you mentioned,
well, that's good. Humility is a virtue.
I'm not sure it's humility. It's just inarticulate.
I'm sure not.
Right after high school, went into the Army, was trained as a helicopter pilot, had a tour in Vietnam, came back, got caught in what they called a reduction in force, went to the University of Iowa, took Air Force ROTC, became an Air Force officer on both active duty and in the reserve for a number of years. In the meantime, I was investigating UFOs. After 9/11, I went into the Iowa National Guard and had a tour in Iraq and finally retired from the National Guard in June of last year as a lieutenant colonel. So I had a long military career, but that didn't impact my UFO research. The interest in the what's now known as crash retrievals, UFO crashes, really kind of sprung out of the work of Len Stringfield, who was a researcher living in Cincinnati. And for the longest time inside the UFO community, no one would really listen to stories of UFO crashes because it seemed that they were just impossible to accept. It was something that just wouldn't happen. And Len got us all to take a look at some of these stories and maybe investigate the idea that some of these crashes might be real. And about the same time, I was invited to participate in an investigation with the Center for UFO Studies, and they wanted to look into the idea that something had crashed outside of Roswell, New Mexico, back in 1947. And as we, and when I say we, Don Schmidt and I conducted the lion's share of the investigation in the beginning, as we worked through all of that, we began to, or we concluded that something extraterrestrial had fallen in New Mexico, not something conventional, not something unusual, but something extraterrestrial. And that's based on our research, the people we interviewed, the things that we had seen over several years and many, many trips into Roswell, talking with the primary people involved in it. So that's kind of how we got off into UFO crashes. It all grew out of kind of the work of Len Stringfield and this idea that the center wanted to take another look at the Roswell case. Doing that, it led me to other tales of UFO crashes. I think there are very few solid tales. The stories are usually single witness. If we can get into the ones where there's multiple witnesses and multiple chains of evidence, we have a much stronger case, and there's a lot of things that are misidentified. But that's, starting with the Roswell case, I kind of moved out into looking at all these other cases of UFO crashes and to see what kind of evidence we could find on that.
Well, certainly the Roswell case was so utterly remarkable. I think 2,000 people were either interviewed by Tom Carey and Don Schmidt in that book, Roswell Incident, The Truth About Roswell,
no,
or
that was,
their
families
or whatever.
Don Schmidt and I published two books about Roswell, the UFO Crash at Roswell and The Truth About the UFO Crash at Roswell. The later books were by Tom Carey and Don Schmidt.
Yeah. And I had Tom Carey on the show. It was pretty riveting, too. We talked a lot about the magic metal. What is it called? It's not called magic metal.
Metal molecules with a memory is what we referred to it as.
And that is, of course, very fascinating. And so many stories have come out about that and have been exposed in that book. And I'm still hoping that we're going to see some of that memory metal soon. What do you think about the Disclosure Project by ExoPolitics?
I think they're off in the wrong direction. I don't think they're going to be able to force anything. And with the Disclosure Project, I think their problem, and I've actually mentioned this to Steve Greer more than once, is that they don't properly vet the witnesses. They will embrace practically any story that's being told without making sure that it's accurate, that the person is who he says he was, or the information is unique. And the best example of that is, at one point, there was an Air Force lieutenant colonel claiming that he'd seen a message about a UFO crash come through the message center when he was a communications officer in the Air Force. Story's absolutely true. Not a problem with that. There was this message. I've got copies of it. The problem is, it refers to the Spitsbergen crash, which is a demonstrable hoax. So they're presenting this guy who's telling a story that's true. It sounds exotic, but the explanation is right there for anybody who wants it. And I think that kind of damages their reputation if they'd properly vet the witnesses and say, well, yeah, the government looked at this stuff, and in this case they have a solution. Going through the Project Blue Book files, as I did as I was doing the work for this book, I found reports of many crashes, as a matter of fact. Most of them are explained, but a couple of them are very intriguing, and I include those in the book because I thought, you know, here is government investigation, here is government information. Maybe if I publicize this information, somebody out there who was involved in this case might tell us a little bit more and give us another clue. And that's kind of what Disclosure is attempting to do, is bring this information forward, but I think they need to kind of vet everything a little bit better than they have been in the past.
Well, that's what's so great about having you on, because you're kind of an insider, and I'm sure that you've got some pretty interesting experience and information that we may not have heard before.
In this respect, the only UFO information I came across while I was in the military was very, very generic and not very spectacular. It was just basically sighting reports by air crews and things like that. The really good stuff went somewhere else, but through some of the connections I had... Pardon me?
I laughed.
Through some of the connections that I had in the military, I was able to learn a couple of things about the Roswell case, and by bringing that experience to bear on the investigations, I was able to eliminate some things that had confused people in the past and clarify parts of the situation. So the training that I had is in the military helped me kind of focus my research for the book.
I see. And did you ever, when you were at work, when you were in the military, were you ever informed of the so-called orders to shoot any UFO craft out of the sky that were given to the Air Force?
Those orders and those kinds of things happened in the early 1950s, particularly. And when I was in the Air Force, I was with an airlifter unit, so those sorts of orders wouldn't have filtered down to us because we were flying cargo planes. As an Army officer, and it's a bizarre career because I was a pilot in the Army but not in the Air Force, but as an Army officer, and especially gearing up to go to Iraq and all that, our focus was on something else, so none of that came to us. In discussions with pilots, for example, during my Air Force career, I talked to a lieutenant colonel who had been at the Toorak Air Force Base when the fighter disappeared on radar back in 1953, and he told me about other sightings that had taken place in that area about the same time, which do not appear in the Project Blue Book files, by the way, which is very interesting. And although they hadn't been given orders to shoot down UFOs, what they did was they found themselves being paced by a UFO one day and decided to turn into it to see how it would react. And, of course, it took off and left without any sort of engagement there. So those are the kind of things I know. So that when you talk about the orders to shoot one down, that was before my time, and that sort of thing had ended long before I got into the Air Force.
Or at least you haven't heard any more about it.
I have nothing exciting to bring to the table on that one, no.
Okay. I'm interested, of course, the obvious question is, so we've got military planes reporting being chased by UFOs, turning a UE, hanging a UE in the sky to confront them and seeing them go off into the next galaxy, and yet we can't seem to get the government to come clean on this, and we still have people telling people like me that I'm out of my mind because I believe in them. So what goes here?
What we need to do so that people don't think you're out of your mind is find the physical evidence for it. Create the multiple chains of evidence that we need. Eyewitness testimony is good, but it's only good so far and can only lead us so far. Another chain of evidence.
Right, but if I can interject, we have the physical testimony in the remnants of memory metal from Roswell, but we're not allowed to look at them.
So if
there is evidence, is it going to be covered up and held back from us? I mean,
this is the argument.
The argument is if there was evidence, then we could come out with it, but the evidence seems to always get hidden, i.e., and we're going to talk about this, craft that are being held in Area 151, i.e. memory metal that would surely prove that it's an extraterrestrial phenomenon. And so, boom, it all disappears. What do you have to say about that?
Well, what I'm trying to get at here is simply we outside the government, need to create the multiple chains of evidence so that we can prove our point. If we could get into the specific archives, if we could get our hands on that sort of debris, then, yeah, we can prove the case pretty easily. If one of them would land in an area, Central Park, in New York, for example, so that the government couldn't control that information, which is what happened in Roswell. The event took place in a very isolated area in 1947, and the government can control the media. They can move the principal witnesses around so that the media couldn't get to them, and the story sort of died there. If we could get something like that to happen, then we could move forward. But we spin our wheels too often, I think, by trying to recreate investigations that have gone on in the past. We need to kind of move forward and bring new information to the table, which is one of the things I attempted to do in the book, was by looking at events that took place after the turn of the century. Unfortunately for us in the UFO field, most of those events are explainable. One of them is very interesting, which is the crash of something in Needles, California in 2008 that George Knapp had investigated, and it's clear that something fell out of the sky, but what is intriguing is that the military or the government was there within 20 minutes to retrieve it, which suggests either it was some sort of an experiment that had gotten off the ranges in the Nellis area, or it was something they were tracking and they were able to respond to it that quickly and pick it up. I think it was probably terrestrially based, but there's always the possibility that it was something extraterrestrial. But the real point is how fast the recovery operation was deployed and how fast they got the stuff out of the area, out of Needles, California. It hits the ground about 2 o'clock in the morning, and by 6 o'clock, everything's gone. And you've just got the memories of...
Are you talking about the episode where they came in with helicopters and lifted it out?
Yes, absolutely. In 2008, they were there with us.
Right, and people described it. The people that saw this described it as something that was glowing, looked really hot. Right.
It was glowing. It was cylindrical. It could be some kind of an experimental craft, some kind of an experimental rocket. Could be something extraterrestrial. But the real point is, they got there with the helicopters, as you point out, very, very quickly, and lifted it out. And I was able to talk to George Knapp about that and get some of his good information to include in the book.
And what did he say?
Well, George and I kind of came to the same conclusion that it was probably some sort of an experiment that got away from him, but we don't know what kind of experiment. We don't know what the basis of the experiment was, meaning what induced them to create this thing, how they came across the information to create it. And the government was right there to retrieve it. But it's also possible what fell was not something terrestrially based. It was something that they had been tracking with various sensors, and as it got close to the ground, as it fell to the ground, they were able to deploy a recovery team that quickly. The fact they got there that quickly seems to suggest it was some sort of an experiment, but there's always the possibility they were watching this thing and realized it was in trouble and were ready to deploy as quickly as they could when they learned it was down.
Exactly. Was that happening near Area 151?
Well, that was in the Needles, California area, and if you take a look at the map, you see that Needles, California is right across the river, very close to Laughlin, Nevada, which is not all that far from Las Vegas, which is not all that far from Area 51. But Nellis Air Force Base is right there in Las Vegas. Nellis Air Force Base controls an awful lot of land around Las Vegas in their ranges. So if you have something going on at Area 51 and you're conducting an experiment, you've got an awful lot of government property and controlled area to conduct your experiment. If it gets away from you, it'll probably fall on the ranges or government land. In this case, it got off the ranges and fell into an area near Needles, California, but the government was able to get there and recover it very, very quickly.
Well, for the listeners, I just want to say that this enactment of this crash appeared on Discovery Channel just a few days ago, and it's probably playing again and again. So keep your eyes peeled. It's quite fascinating. You see the helicopters coming in and lifting off this glowing hunk of something, and a lot of questions and ideas about what that is. Another crash, as Kevin says, or perhaps, who knows, something out of the military toy room. Yeah. Well, let's move on to the big question, and that is, obviously, you believe in UFOs and extraterrestrial life.
I believe we have been visited, yes.
Okay. Now, do you also believe that we have these guys, we have some extraterrestrial beings working with the government?
No, I do not.
No, you don't?
No, I don't believe. What I believe, based on my research, and that means it's limited to my research and somebody else's research, you know, if they've got something better, let's see the evidence. But based on what I know, something fell at Roswell. That something was obviously extraterrestrial, as a number of the people who were involved in the recovery operation told me, including people only I talked to because of the way the investigation grew. But that was extraterrestrial. They recovered the craft. They recovered bodies. And there is some evidence that one may have survived for a period of time, maybe as long as 2 or 3 years before it died. But I don't
know. Wow, what is the evidence for that?
There's a number of witnesses who talked about one being alive after the crash. There's a witness who claimed that they had seen a creature walking into the base hospital in Roswell in 1947. And I talked to an officer who said that he was involved in the project that sort of debriefed this alien creature before it passed away. But that information is like single witness or one or two witnesses, and we don't have real good corroboration for it. And so this is something that you kind of look at and you want to follow up on it as best you can, and you do so. But there are other areas of investigation that have been more fruitful for me, at least, and I've kind of pursued those when I've had the opportunity.
Okay, well, I want to move on to those in a minute, but I'm very excited and curious about what you've just said, because this is news to me. I never heard that a military officer was able to debrief the alien being at Roswell. So even if it's only subjective information, can you give us some information about what he told you?
Well, certainly. In my conversations with him, one of the things he had done was go to Roswell after the events took place and go through the records and make sure everything had been removed so that there was no paper trail back to it. And one of the functions that he had had during this time was to meet with the survivor or a possible survivor of the crash. And he said that he would sit in one room and the being would be in another room, and they would attempt to communicate as best they could during those times. And I'm being a little vague because he gave the impression it didn't survive a long time, but there's some evidence that suggested it might have survived a couple of years. But there was this sort of an investigation that took place. The problem is I have it from a single source, and I cannot corroborate his role in that specific investigation, and that's what we need to do. I did talk about
right, but
this.
Nonetheless, it is very curious to think that someone has, this is the first I'm hearing of anyone having had a chance to debrief or interview that alien being.
Well,
so
even though it might
not be provable, it's very interesting for me to hear.
Well, I published a book called Case MJ-12 a number of years ago, and some of the discussions with that officer are included in the book. So it's information that has been out for a number of years now. I think the book was published in 2002. So it's information that's been out there for a while, but I have... From that point, I've not been able to corroborate that information to my satisfaction. So I've kind of followed the Len Stringfield path here, which was Len's idea was, let's publish the information and see if that can induce somebody else to tell us a little bit more and maybe lead us to the evidence we need. So that information was included in the Case MJ-12 book. With that thought in mind, here is some of the information I've come across. Can we maybe find someone else who was involved in another aspect of it and generate some additional corroboration?
Okay, well, let's move on to those things that you say that you can, that were more interesting to you because you could find corroboration.
All right. Did you have something
to say? Okay, go. you're such a wizard. You know so much. It's like sitting down at a banquet, a UFO banquet here. I'm interested in also, well, we've got the Sag Harbor event, which we haven't talked about
yet. I was just thinking the same thing, meaning that we have some sort of a psychic connection here. And Sag Harbor is very, very important for a couple of reasons. Number one, there's a lot of documentation for it. Don Ledger and Chris Stiles have done a wonderful job of chasing the Canadian government documentation on it. Sag Harbor was an event that took place in October of 1967. This is a time when the Condon Committee, the Air Force-sponsored UFO investigation, was going on. The Condon Committee gets a report that something has fallen into Sag Harbor. They make a couple of phone calls. They decide it's not worth their effort to investigate, even though that's what they're supposed to be doing, investigating UFOs, and here is a great case. But they decided, well, it just involved a couple of teenagers. We don't care. We're not going to do anything with it. Don Ledger and Chris Stiles followed up on this, and they were able to find documentation showing that the Canadian government and the American government did respond to this thing that was seen to fall into the lake, a bright glowing object falling into the harbor. It left a residue on the surface for a while, which eventually dissipated. They tracked the thing underwater for a period of time. They sent divers down trying to find it. They did all sorts of things like that. Canadian government, as they say, had documentation about it. So we fulfilled a couple of things. We've got lots of eyewitnesses to what happened, including police officers, Canadian military officers, a couple of American military officers, a number of the clergymen who were involved. They've talked to the divers who were involved, or one or two of the divers were involved. And then, on top of all of that, that wonderful eyewitness testimony and corroboration going on there, they found documentation. So we've got two chains of evidence. We have the eyewitness testimony, we have the documentation. And the documentation clearly says something fell, clearly says that they attempted to retrieve it, clearly says they were interested in finding out what it was, and clearly says after about a week, the indications that something was there disappeared. There's even a suggestion that a Soviet submarine was involved in this, so the Soviet government at the time attempted to determine what had fallen into Sag Harbor. So this is a very good, solid case of a UFO-type crash. Maybe it was just what in the military we would have called an emergency landing, where they had to land so they could repair something. But whatever it was, it fell into Sag Harbor, and it eventually left the area.
Okay, we're back. Some of you are going to be saying, how weird, talking about crashing UFOs and suddenly the line goes out. So we're going to try to pick up where we were. Thank you, Kevin, for hanging in there. You're still with me, right?
Yes, I am.
All right. Well, we're going to get this out regardless of whether the airwaves don't want to put us through.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I was doing an interview on Coast to Coast Tuesday night, and 3 minutes before the interview was conducted, we lost all power in the house. And so I'm scrambling around trying to find lights and everything so we can go on the air and do that. And now we're having all this trouble at your end. So maybe the government has decided they don't like my message.
That's what I was asking you at the beginning. How do you get away with being a military guy, ex-guy, and talking about this? And, however, it could also be that there are other energies that are you know, when you're talking about ETs, strange things happen.
I've had a lot of strange things happening in the last few weeks as we begin to talk about this new book, so I don't know.
What kind of strange things are happening?
Well, as I say, I mean, 3 minutes before I'm to go on the air, the power all goes out in the house, which causes all kinds of complications in attempting to do this. Now we're having this sort of discussion, and I've had it happen on a couple of other radio interviews in the last few days where we haven't quite made the connection properly, or they're having all kinds of problems with the equipment. And I've done, over the years, I've probably done 1,500, 2,000 radio interviews, and I've never run into a string of complications with doing the interviews like this. It almost seems, if I was of a paranoid mind, and I'm certainly not, that somebody wanted to keep my message from getting out because there was something in the book that they didn't like. And while I think there's probably people in the UFO community who aren't going to like some of the conclusions I draw on some of the crashes, it would seem to me that someone with the power to create these sorts of communications problems would be in the government, and they wouldn't like some of the positive things I've said about UFO crashes. So I don't know.
Well, that's pretty optimistic on your part, Kevin, because there's no question that the cover-up is in full tilt. So, I think it's going to make much more excitement around the book. So let me just remind people that the book is entitled Crash When UFOs Fall from the Sky, and maybe whoever is affecting the airwaves confused crash as in crash the computer system. But what's great is people like you and me will not be stopped, and we will continue to talk and bring out the information as much as we possibly can. And we're not trying to aggravate anyone, and we're just trying to shed light on the greatest secret that seems to have been held back from the human race.
And I've said that for years and years and years. This is the biggest secret of the millennium. I mean, we're talking about contact with an alien race, and yet we're still arguing about whether the contact has in fact taken place, where that question should have been answered 60 years ago or 70 years ago, and we should be directing our attention somewhere else, and yet we're still sort of scrambling around at the very bottom level of the investigation. We should be beyond that in attempting to find out the answers to questions like, how do they travel interstellar distances? How can we apply that technology to our problems on Earth and maybe fix some of the problems we have? And yet we still are arguing about whether or not they've actually visited us.
Well, it would appear to me that the powers that be may very well be investigating that information. They just don't want us to know about it.
I sometimes suspect that the materials they recovered in the crash retrieval is of a technology that's so far advanced they have yet to understand it. They cannot properly decode it. And I've said it would be kind of akin to taking a VCR and a television back to Merlin the Magician and say, duplicate this. And before he can do that, he's got to be able to understand electricity and magnetism, two things that are invisible, and yet if you know the secret, you can take that black ribbon out of the videotape, and you can get pictures and sounds and all sorts of information from it. And I'm wondering if the materials that we've recovered at Roswell, for example, aren't a technology that is so much further advanced than ours, we haven't figured out how to decode it yet and understand it. And so because of that, the government keeps it under wraps. The thing that you keep coming back to, which was the memory metal, the molecules with the memory, and think what that would do to, say, repair shop, automotive repair shops. You drive your car into a pole, and you back up, and the fenders spring back to the original shape because the metal remembers what it's supposed to look like. We do have something similar to that in today's technology, but it requires the application of heat to get the molecules to realign the way they were originally. But the descriptions that we have from the Roswell case of taking this aluminum foil type stuff and wadding it into a ball and dropping it on the table, and it unfolds itself and goes back to its original shape. We have nothing like that in our technology today, and it may be we have not figured out how to make that. And I also wonder
Tom Perry was telling me on the show that he had been contacted by a guy who was in a laboratory and had some kahuna from the government came in, dropped a box of bits on his table and said, back engineer this. Are you familiar with that story?
Well, there's a number of those stories that have floated around. There's also a suggestion that a group in Ohio had investigated some of that stuff, and the reports from their investigations have disappeared, and people haven't been able to get a hold of that information, which would suggest that they had been given something like that and told to determine what it was or how it was made or how we can duplicate it. And the experiments conducted on that material have disappeared from the archives and their records. So there's a number of those stories going around. What we need to do is actually find some of those records and chase them. I was looking for the reports and the documents surrounding the Air Force reinvestigation of Roswell in the mid-1990s, and I still haven't gotten to the information that would have been passed from the Secretary of the Air Force to the various agencies and the groups investigating parts of the Roswell case. They keep giving me the runaround, sending me from place to place to place, saying, well, all of that information would be at the government accounting offices. No, it wouldn't. It would be in the files of the Secretary of the Air Force, but I haven't been able to track that stuff down. And even under the Freedom of Information Act, I haven't been able to get anything that is of great importance to me.
Hmm. What about Chag Harbor? That's what made the line drop.
I don't know how deeply we got into that, and I'm not sure
I had said to you, let's talk about Chag Harbor, and you said, yeah, we're just going to go there, and then the line dropped.
What I was talking about.
So let's try to go there again and see what happens.
Okay. The Chag Harbor.
If it drops again, we know we're on to something.
Yeah, there you go. The Chag Harbor case is important because, A, it came about in October of 1967 when the Air Force-sponsored university study, University of Colorado, the so-called Condon Committee, was investigating UFOs. And here is a sighting, something that happened while they're working to investigate UFOs, and their whole investigation was make a phone call or two to Chag Harbor and determine that, well, only a couple of teenagers saw something, we're not going to investigate. A fellow named Chris Stiles and another fellow named Don Ledger, both Canadians have looked into this case and have uncovered a great number of documents from the Canadian government that relates to Chag Harbor. They've interviewed witnesses who were involved in the investigation. They've they've talked to divers who were attempting to find out what had fallen into Chag Harbor. There's even a photograph.
Okay, well, please be a little bit more clear. You're fading out. What exactly, what is the incident? What occurred? Can you run it down for the people that don't know about Chag Harbor?
In October of 1967, a number of people saw an object in the sky, saw it descending or falling toward Chag Harbor, hit the water, disappeared, left a foamy yellow residue on the surface for a while, and then that disappeared. The government, and this would be the Canadian government, the Canadian law enforcement, responded to it. They put divers down trying to find out what it was. The United States government also responded and had ships in the area trying to determine what had happened. And there's even a possibility of a Soviet submarine had gone into the area. This object was believed to be under the surface of the water for at least a week, and then the indications that it was there disappeared. So something had was seen to fall into the water. There was residue on the water. There was a response by the government to find out what was going on, and the thing disappeared. Stiles and Ledger have spent years trying to recover documents about this and have had some success, so they can prove that the Canadian government responded to it. Some of the documentation they have goes a lot deeper than what we've been able to recover from Roswell. So it's a much better case in that respect because the documentation is a lot thicker for it than what we've been able to to recover from Roswell. But they've talked to the witnesses who were involved, members of the Canadian military, members of the dive teams who went down, even members of the Canadian clergy who were somehow involved in the retrieval operation. But they've also come across evidences of the cover-up. Stiles was given, was looking for what they call, I believe, the Stoker's Report. And the one that he wanted that would have covered the period of Shag Harbor was missing for a long time. Somebody had taken it from where it was supposed to be and hidden it. So there's evidence of a cover-up there as well. So it's a very important case because of all of those things. And it rivals Roswell only because of the documentation available for it.
I see. Do you believe that there are underwater alien bases on this planet?
I don't think there's bases, but there's very good evidence that there's some kind of underwater craft or alien craft are operating in our oceans, because there's been so much information available about that, the underwater UFOs, if you will, the undersea UFOs, USOs. But I'm reluctant to get into the idea that there are bases on Earth that are manned by the aliens, simply because, from my perspective, and I'm just saying from my perspective, I haven't seen the evidence that is, for me, conclusive. I know others believe those things, and the evidence for them is conclusive. So it's just a level of what you accept as evidence and where you want to go with it. So I'm skeptical of the idea, but it doesn't mean that there are no bases. It just means I would like to see some additional evidence for that.
Well, I appreciate that position, but on the other hand, you are saying that a number of people reported the Shag Harbor incident. So what you're saying is that very well might have happened, but you're not buying necessarily the idea that there's a whole network of bases.
I'm not buying the idea there's a whole network. Clearly something fell into Shag Harbor. And it seems
that... I just want to make sure we're on the same page on that.
Pardon me?
I just wanted to make sure we were on the same page on that.
Okay.
And while we're talking about underwater bases, this is going to be a question that's probably going to be too esoteric for you, but I'm very interested in the possibility of connection or interspecies connection with dolphins and whales. And some people propose that the dolphins and whales are contacted by extraterrestrials, and I'm just wondering in any of your files or investigations, if you've ever heard anything similar.
That would be an area outside my expertise. I'm a little bit more of a nuts and bolts type guy, so that is where I direct my research. And there's all these subsets of ufology, whether it's crop circles or animal mutilations or alien abductions. There's all these subsets, and UFO crashes fits into one of the subsets. And so my investigations have taken me into the subset of UFO crashes and not these other arenas, because that was where my interest lied.
I understand. Have you investigated any other UFO crashes?
Well, I've looked at quite a few of them, as we talk about in the book. I've worked with, and I say worked with, which is kind of a euphemism, but I've been in contact with Stan Gordon for the Kecksburg UFO crash that took place in 1965. I've done the lion's share of the work of the events that took place in April of 1962 out in the Las Vegas area, where we had the object land in the Eureka Nephi area of Utah, take off, made a looping turn over the Reno area, and it was seen to explode out toward the east of Las Vegas. Object was tracked on radar. Air Force was involved. Air Force actually talked about the object being tracked on radar. And what the Air Force did, which is really interesting on this one, is the Utah end of the sightings, they used Zulu time, which is Greenwich Mean Time, and in the Las Vegas end of the sightings, they used local time. So it looked like the events took place on two separate days and hours apart, where in fact they really took place 16 minutes apart. So you've got to... If you link the sightings together, you have no reasonable explanation. If you separate them, then you can begin to suggest explanations that make sense. But once they're linked, the explanations simply don't work.
Certainly, we can agree that there's a lot of activity in Nevada, whether or not it's all UFO or extraterrestrial craft, or whether it's our own guys doing testing. It's a buzz of an area.
There is all kinds of bizarre stuff going on. And if you take a look at Area 51, I'm of the opinion that the research going on there is the next generation of military aircraft, but there's the other information that suggests something of an extraterrestrial nature is going on there as well. So it's really where you want to come down on which side of the fence you want to come down on, whether it's extraterrestrial, whether it happens to be terrestrially based, but there's an awful lot of interesting stuff going on at Area 51.
Well, there are people reporting that there are alien craft being worked on in there.
Yes, I know.
Do you know
anything about
that?
And they're the results of craft that have been recovered in the in various UFO crashes. The problem is, and here, with most of the crashes, when we can trace the debris or the recovered items, we usually can trace them to Ohio, which is a facility for reverse engineering all kinds of stuff. We don't really trace them to Area 51. What we have there is people who say, yeah, the stuff is here, but we don't have the ability to trace it from where it was recovered to Area 51 as we do taking stuff from where it was recovered to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base.
And that is an Air Force Base in Ohio?
Yes. Yes.
I see. It's interesting stuff. I wish we had more time to talk with Kevin D. Randall, PhD, by the way, but our time has run out, and I really want to apologize to you all who had trouble getting the streaming for this hour of dynamic conversation and for the line dropping for those few minutes. But, you know, we're trying to do a international talk show here, and things can happen. So always stay tuned in. The name of the book, again, is When UFOs Fall from the Sky. Crash is the title, When UFOs Fall from the Sky, author Kevin D. Randall. Kevin, we've got 1 minute. You've got a message to leave us about what you're doing and what your perspective is for the disclosure of all of this. When will the government ever tell us what they know?
I think we had a real opportunity in the mid-1990s, and we allowed ourselves to get distracted from the message. And I'm not sure when we're going to be able to create that synchronicity we had going in the mid-1990s again. But that's what we need to do so that we can kind of force the government's hand. We allowed it to get away from us in the 1990s, and we need to bring that sort of focus back to back into play so that we can force out the disclosure.
Oh, boy, I'll tell you, it's such an exciting time to be alive, isn't it?
Absolutely.
I mean, it's always important to come away from all of these conversations and concerns, because obviously having governments that hide reality and truth from us seems to be the way of humankind. But nonetheless, I remember when I was a kid, and I was 12 years old, I think, when I first heard about the Project Blue Book, and I remember trying to get my hands on that information back then. And here we are, and at the time, I mean, nobody was talking about that, at least not my local 12-year-old. But here we are in this generation of just all of this information coming out. And I think that the very nature of the beast, the fact that so much information is coming to the foreground now, is just a precursor to this also finally coming out. And it feels like it's coming very soon. Are you with me?
Yes, yes.
Do you agree with that?
I think we need to keep the pressure up. I think we need to keep our research going. I think we need to look at it from a scientific perspective. Use the scientific method to accomplish our investigations, and by doing so, we're going to bring a lot more people into the fold. And by doing that, we'll be able to get to the bottom line, find out what's really going on.
Yeah, okay. I've got good news. We've got an extra 7 minutes to talk, so don't go away yet. And I wanted to say that, yes, and we have people like you to thank for that, and the really solid people that are in the military and the Air Force and the scientists and the physicists who are finally coming clean with what they know. It's exciting to know that people like you are fearless to be able to speak your truth about this, knowing, as you must know, that there is definitely a cap on this information coming out to the public. And I salute you for that.
Well, the thing is, I've never really had trouble with my military career, for example. And everyone seemed to know of my interest in UFOs. When I went to Richards Grauer Air Force Base for an assignment with the Air Force, the host officer took me to the officer's club for lunch, and we got to talk, and he says, you know, I was just reading this interesting article about UFOs, and he was kind of explaining it to me. I said, yeah, I know, I wrote that one. And so that sort of information has always been in the records, I guess you could say. The government, the military has always known of my interest in UFOs, known that I've had, in many cases, a national platform for my ideas, whether it happens to be a magazine article or later radio programs and television programs that I had the opportunity to appear on. I've always had a vast forum for my opinions and my ideas, and it never seemed to hurt my military career in any way. If there was any harm done to my military career, it was me doing it by making the wrong choice. It seemed invariably if I had two choices to make, I took the wrong one, where the other path would have been a better path to take. But I've never really experienced any problems with the military or anybody saying, well, you can't research that, you can't do that. The only things that's ever been said to me were suggestions, don't use your military rank when you write the stories while you're serving, because it implies, and I understand this, implies an acceptance by the military of what you write. You've now become sort of a spokesman.
An endorsement.
But when I've moved out of the military arenas, then it's perfectly acceptable for me to use my rank or whatever on my writings. So it's kind of that sort of thing. So I've never had a problem with the military or anybody inhibiting my investigations in any sort of an official capacity. The trouble I've had is with some of my colleagues in the UFO field, and sometimes they don't like my message. Sometimes I don't like their message, and that's the only real conflict I've ever come across in my UFO research.
Until now.
I other than the things that have happened in the last few days.
That's what I'm referring to.
And I'm not sure whether that is more coincidence than anything else, but it seems odd that, I mean, you're within 3 minutes of going on to a radio program and all the power goes out, which complicates doing...
Yeah, I mean, it's never happened to me before that there was a complete breakdown of communication for so long in an interview. It can happen, the line drops, but then it comes right back. This was, you know, silencing for quite a while.
Yes.
So pay attention. Obviously, guys, there's something in this book that you've got to read. And I find it pretty exciting that...
I'm going to take it as an endorsement for my book. That's what I'm going to do. That there's something
you
in the book that is so good.
You PR portfolio.
Yeah.
The book that makes the electric circuits and telephone lines drop.
Yes.
Gosh. You know, there's so much more I wanted to ask you about. You know, your bio talks about alien home. What is it called? Alien home intervention.
Well,
what's that about?
I was doing abduction research in the mid 1970s, and I was the first one to report that the victims of the abduction said that the aliens came into the house to get them. It's the first time that had been reported. Now, there's an awful lot of those sorts of reports, and people say, well, that's been happening to me long before the mid-1970s. But But none of it had been reported until I did in an article for Saga's UFO report about a family from Utah that it said that they had been abducted and that the aliens came into the house at the time. So it's the first time that had been reported. So I've managed to be on the forefront of some things in the UFO field, which means I've been around forever, I guess, which is not necessarily a good thing.
Well, I can't believe I have not run into you until now, and I'm going to devour this book, and I'm going to ask you to come back on, if you will, so that we can explore more deeply and without interruption. Will you do that?
Oh, absolutely. Sounds like a good time.
Okay, Caitlin. All right, folks, we've gotten our extra few minutes here. I'm just going to sum it up again. If you've been listening, if you caught any of this interview, and, oh, Kevin, how about a website? Do you have one?
Yes, you can go to www.kevinrandall, and it's the Randall is R-A-N-D-L-E, kevinrandall.blogspot.com, or just type a different perspective UFO into your search engine, and you should come up to my blog.
All right, that's great. And again, this great book, whew, it's an intense read because it's full of science and history and detail and just immense experience. And I'm going to try to, read this on the plane.